WMNF Tampa. This is Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. And as we heard at the top of the NPR headlines there, tomorrow is the anniversary of the death of George Floyd. He was killed by police. One of the police officers has been found guilty of murder and manslaughter. George Floyd's death set off months of protests around the world against police violence and racism. Today on Midpoint, we're going to look back at the 1 year since the death of George Floyd. We're going to spend some time focusing on the WMNF mission calendar for the month of May, which is mental health awareness. And if you or a loved one are in a mental health crisis, please call 211. That's 211. Today on the show, we're going to hear part of a recent forum by the ACLU of Florida that examined the state of mental health among Black Americans. Later on, we're going to take your calls. In the meantime, you can email your thoughts to DJ at WMNF.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. Please sign your name if you text us. Before we get into the first segment, I want to read a news story or two from the headlines right now. The Tampa Bay Times is reporting that the St. Petersburg City Council member Robert Blackman has resigned effective next January. That likely signals that he is going to be running for mayor. Three of the other prominent mayoral candidates who are in the race already are Ken Welch, Wengay Newton, and Darden Rice. So we will be following that race throughout the summer and the spring. Also, I want to mention that today, about an hour ago, the civil rights groups were applauding the city council's vote. This is in Tampa. Tampa City Council's vote on a revamped citizen review board. And they are criticizing Mayor Jane Castor's bid for control. So this is from a media advisory. And they had a press conference that started around 11, and it was going on the last time I checked. Here are some of the groups that are involved in that Tampa area press conference. The NAACP, the Dream Defenders, ACLU, and other civil rights group are speaking out today on Tampa City Council's passage of a stronger citizen review board, and they're demanding answers from Mayor Jane Castor on accountability and transparency. Some of the people who spoke were Yvette Lewis, who is the president of the Hillsborough County NAACP, Bernice Lordan from Tampa Dream Defenders, Gretchen Cothran, a lawyer who is president of the Greater Tampa Chapter of the ACLU of Florida. Julius Adams is a former law enforcement officer. He's a legal panel member of the ACLU with the group Tampa for Justice. Kelly Benjamin spoke as well, that down there at Tampa City Hall in downtown Tampa. So those are civil rights groups who are applauding Tampa City Council's vote on a revamped citizen review board, and they're slamming Mayor Jane Castor's bid for control over that review board. And that's going to get into a lot of really what we're going to be talking about this hour. So in the first segment, we're going to look at an online conversation hosted by the ACLU of Florida. It happened about 10 days ago, and it's called Mental Health in the Black Community. We're going to hear a small, short segment of this. It features Darnell Lamont Walker. He's an award-winning writer, filmmaker, and artist. He currently lives between South Africa and North Georgia. He's hitching himself around the globe, collecting stories and recipes to share. And his first film, Seeking Asylum, explores safe spaces around the world for Black Americans who want to escape American injustice. And then he created Outside the House, that explores mental health in the Black community. His latest, Set Yourself on Fire, is a film about rape and sexual assault around the world. It's his goal to continue to develop and empower people and communities around the world. So let's listen to this first segment of this ACLU of Florida online forum, online conversation that's called Mental Health in the Black Community, featuring Darnell Lamont Walker.
I would like to introduce Darnell Lamont Walker, who is an award-winning writer, filmmaker, and artist. He is a native of Charlottesville, Virginia, and currently living between South Africa and North Georgia, and hitching himself around the globe, collecting stories and recipes to share. How do we get in on that? I want to get in on the recipes. He's a creator of children's media content with Nine Story Media Group, writing for shows like Blue's Clues and You, and the coming Netflix animated series Karma's World. Having found the intersection where a degree in communication and culture and his art meet, he is currently touring and lecturing on strategies and approaches of effective leaders based on film and television classics. His first film, Seeking Asylum, explores safe spaces around the world for Black Americans seeking to escape American injustice. Next, Darnell created Outside the House, exploring mental health in the Black community, and his latest, Set Yourself on Fire, a film about rape and sexual assault around the world. It is his goal to continue to develop and empower people and communities around the world. So welcome, Darnell Lamont Walker.
I appreciate being here. It's great. And I've been keeping up with the series across social media, the speaking series. And so it's been an honor to come in and speak, especially about outside the house and everything that surrounds that, you know? I definitely want to talk about how I got into that film and became the advocate for mental health in the Black community. And so what happened, you know, in 2015, Freddie Gray was killed in Baltimore by the police. And I had a trip planned to go and backpack through Europe already. The trip was already planned. And so my first stop was Norway. And I had a friend who says, you know, what are you going to Norway for? Are you going to seek asylum there? And I thought, hey, you know, actually, that's not a bad idea, given everything that's happened in the States. You know, Freddie Gray was killed, you know, right on the heels of Mike Brown in Ferguson. We were on the ground there. We were in Baltimore. We were in Detroit. We were in D.C., all over the place. And I thought maybe it's best to go somewhere and find another home where I can feel safe, where I can raise children, where I can have a family, where I don't have to fear not making it home at night. So I grabbed my camera. I wasn't a filmmaker at the time. Strangely, I was a writer. I've always been a writer, but I wasn't making film. And so I had this broken Canon and my cell phone. And I just went around five countries in Europe and asked people on the street, like, hey, you know, Black Americans wanted to come here because we feel unsafe at home. Will you welcome us with open arms? And I had hours and hours of footage. You know, we were in Amsterdam, Norway, London, Paris, you know, and South Africa eventually. But I got home with hours and hours of footage. And I had a friend who said, you know, you should put this footage together and make something of it. I had no plan when I was filming. It was just, I want to have this footage just so I can show people back home that, hey, the rest of the world is looking at what's happening here. And so I put it together and put it out there, and someone called me a filmmaker. Someone said, oh, you're a documentary filmmaker. And it's like, yeah, I'll take that title. That's fine. And we put the film into festivals and it was accepted all across the world because it was about, you know, racial injustice. It was about social issues. And that film opened conversations about the mental health of Black folks in America, being that there's never been a time where we've been here, you know, historically since 1619. That's what the history books say. I'm sure long before that. There's never been a time we've been here that we've been without at least stress. We've been at least stressed and anxious since we've been here. And it was like, well, why aren't we talking about that? You know, I've been to therapy before. I had friends who've been to therapy, but it wasn't something we were sharing. It wasn't information we were talking about. And what led me on the road was, you know, having been, you know, these feelings I had when being pulled over by police for absolutely no reason. The trauma that friends have gone through. I went to school in Daytona Beach, possibly, you know, one of the places that led me down the road toward making these types of films and fighting for social justice. And so I said, okay, well, my next film, we have to talk about that. And so I just got people together and I said, hey, listen, if you've ever sought help for mental health, for your mental health, why did you go? And I put it on Facebook and it was quiet for like an hour, you know, no one was talking. It requires vulnerability on so many levels to open up and say, you know, I went to a therapist because of this or because of that. And eventually, after about an hour, someone came on and said, I went to a therapist because I thought I was going to kill myself one night. And the floodgates opened. It was, you know, there were comments saying, I thought I was the only one who experienced this. I didn't know anyone else went through this. I had the exact same thought. And it was many, you know, I thought my marriage was falling apart. I felt like I was a bad mother. I felt like I was a bad father. I was dealing with childhood trauma. And we had hundreds of comments by the end of the night. And I said, geez, we haven't been talking. I mean, these are some of my closest friends who I've known, I mean, my entire life, and I never knew they were dealing with these things. And so I said, we have to find a safe place to share these things, because I know, like, seeing it on Facebook, seeing what happened on Facebook by providing this, you know, this status, which was this place where we were holding space for each other. I figured if we can do it in a bigger place, we could impact more lives and help other people realize they weren't alone.
Well, that's Darnell Lamont Walker. He is an award-winning writer, filmmaker, and artist, and you're listening to part of an online conversation that was hosted by the ACLU of Florida about a week and a half ago. It was called Mental Health in the Black Community. I'm bringing it to you today specifically because WMNF's mission calendar for the month of May is Mental Health Awareness. And the context here is the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd. That's tomorrow. And George Floyd was killed by police. And one of the police officers has been found guilty of murder and manslaughter. Three others go on trial later this year. George Floyd's death set off months of protests around the world against police violence and against racism. So we're talking about that on Midpoint today. Later on, we're going to hear more about alternatives to policing. And we're talking right now. I'm going to play more of this forum, this online conversation that was hosted by the ACLU of Florida, featuring Darnell Lamont Walker, a filmmaker and artist. His first film was Seeking Asylum. So let's hear more from Darnell Lamont Walker. This is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. It's 12:18 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. This is Midpoint Monday. Later, we're going to be taking your calls, but you can email dj@wmnf.org. If you sign your text, you can text us 813-433-0885. I'd especially like to hear what people think about mental health in the Black community. Give us a call or text or email dj@wmnf.org. Here's more of Darnell Lamont Walker.
And so I reached out to so many of the people on the wall and said, hey, I'm going to make this film. If you'd like to talk about it there, I'll fly to you. You can fly to me. We can get on Zoom. We can get on Skype and make it happen. And that's what we did. This was 2016. And I was just, and at that time, I was making film. I was broke, you know, so I'm all over the states, like, okay, crowdfunding, like, okay, I just need $50 for a bus ticket to this city. I need $20 to get to this city. I was a broke artist. And, but we made it happen. You know, we got, I don't even know, maybe 20, 30 interviews, and then maybe even more, but hours and hours and hours of footage. And again, it was, let's put this together. And with every interview, it became harder and harder to complete, because you start talking about mental health. You know, I'm talking to friends who I was in college with, and they're telling me, you know, my journey down the road of mental illness began when I was 19 and I was assaulted. And I'm like, but I knew you at 19 and I didn't know any of this. And they're like, yeah, I hit it very well. And I was, you know, there were some nights where I didn't think I was going to make it through. I was going to commit suicide. And I'm sitting there just talking. And I'm like, how did I, you know, you start taking it in on your own. And you're saying, why didn't I see this? And they're like, well, I did a great job in hiding it. And I realized that there are so many friends that we have. And so, you know, our parents, our children who are going through so many things alone, and we're not seeing it. I've lost several friends who took their lives, and I, you know, it's always a thought of what could I have done, you know, better? How could I have helped them? And so dealing with this while trying to make the film, so we were 6 months, you know, overdue of putting it out and almost didn't finish. And I sometimes think the only reason the film was finished, because it got really dark and it got really heavy for a while. And I sometimes think the only reason the film was finished is because I'd moved to South Africa at this time, and I was food poisoned. Strangely enough, I got food poisoning at a wedding I went to, and I was sitting at home, and I'm sitting there like, there's nothing I can do right now. And I looked at the footage and I'm like, let's just put this together. And so I think January 5th, I finished the footage, finished putting it together. And I just put it out there, put it online. And I said, I'm going to leave this up for 12 hours. If anyone wants to see it, check it out. I will take it down after about 12 hours and I'm going to submit it to festivals, but I want everyone to have a chance to see it before we get to that point. And I went to sleep, woke up, checked the page to see how many people viewed it, and then checked my inbox. And there were, countless messages from people saying, please don't take this down. You've literally saved my life. Listening to these people's stories made me reach out to a therapist. I thought I would never talk to a therapist. I see people who are going through what I went through. I thought I was alone. I'm not alone. You can't take this down. And immediately I'm like, oh, you're right. Okay, I'll leave it up. And throughout that week, it was just message after message after message saying all of those things. I realized that we have to leave this up. My goal was to show people that they aren't alone and they are, and that's what this film is doing. Let's see. And it was strange because I've always advocated for mental health. You know, I've always advocated for seeking help if you needed help, finding the courage to be vulnerable. I've always done it. You know, I had the shirt on now, Boys Should Cry, all that. But I never thought that this film, I was a filmmaker. You know, I wasn't here to what happened. And I receive it. And it's great. And so once this film went out, I started getting calls from schools, and I'm not a therapist at all. You know, I've been a case manager. That's as close as I've come to being a therapist. But I've gotten calls from schools, from organizations, from therapists, from psychologists, psychiatrists, focusing on Black mental health. It's a population. So many of these schools, like Black folks, these schools haven't really focused on us. These organizations haven't really focused on us. They haven't figured out how to go into the community and build the trust there. And with this film, it wasn't about building trust. I think the trust was already there. And so I've been able to go in and take therapists with me and take psychiatrists, Black psychiatrists and psychologists and counselors with me and say, here, okay, let's figure out how we can service these communities. And so that film has done an amazing job with that. And just like that film, House, you know, I'm talking to participants who are saying, you know, my mental health journey and mental illness journey started when I was assaulted. That was something that, again, we weren't talking about. And I was able to talk to some of the participants and say, well, what if we open that conversation up? And that's what we did. And that led to the film that I put out after that, Set Yourself on Fire, about the global rape epidemic. I started that while living in South Africa and finished it here in the States. But it all tied into, you know, how, like each of the films, Seeking Asylum, Outside the House, and Set Yourself on Fire was, they're all about healing. They're all about finding safe spaces, providing safe spaces for survivors, and figuring out how we can hold space and help others to get to those places. And that's what I'm happy about. I'm happy I was able to do that. And it's been a little over four years. So January 2017, I finished Outside the House. And so it's been a little over 4 years. And it's great to know that, you know, we're still going around talking about it, still going to school, still going to organizations, colleges and universities are showing it. We're talking, you know, and now it's great because I'm standing in bars and I've been to clubs and, you know, we're standing there in a corner and folks are with drinks in their hand are giving therapy referrals. You know, it's like, oh, you should talk to my therapist. And I'm like, this has never happened. I've never seen this. You know, my folks would never talk about this. And I see the changes that are happening. More and more of us are opening up and talking about it, and it's great. So it's great when organizations are putting programs like this together where we can talk about that. and we can find out what our resources are and utilize them to the best of our ability. So I don't know if there are any questions yet, but I will take some if there are any, Cynthia.
Well, that was Darnell Lamont Walker. He was speaking a few days ago, about a week and a half ago, in an online conversation that was hosted by the ACLU of Florida, and it was called Mental Health in the Black Community. Darnell Lamont Walker is an award-winning writer, filmmaker, and artist. His first film, Seeking Asylum, explores safe spaces around the world for Black Americans seeking to escape American justice. He also created Outside the House, exploring mental health in the Black community, and is also creating Set Yourself on Fire, a film about rape and sexual assault around the world. 813-239-9663 if you'd like to join this conversation. I'll probably go to the phones right now for just a bit before we go to our next segment. And I want to remind people that in our next segment, we're going to be talking about the 1 year anniversary of the death of George Floyd and how people are reimagining police. The show we're going to play in a few minutes is called Reimagining a Better World. And this episode is about reimagining public safety, about alternatives to policing, organizing, and budgets. But first, I want to go to the phones. And I'm going to read this quick email that came in. I asked for a follow-up. You'll see what I'm talking about. So this person, James, writes, "What a snowflake, LOL." And I didn't know what James was talking about, so I don't know if he's talking about the person who is speaking there, about his experience, or something else. So I asked James for a follow-up, and James has not responded yet. So I don't know. If you think that we're playing snowflakes here on the air, you can let us know that. Or if you think that some people have a lot of experience and a lot of things to say about certain things that, you know, not everyone necessarily is experiencing, and they're sharing that, and that makes the world a better place, you can tell us that as well. The number is 813-239-9663. I'll take a phone call or two before we go on to our next segment. The first person I want to speak with is Mary in Tampa. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show. What would you like to say?
Hi. So I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I worked in a school, Carver Exceptional Center, for 12 years. Carver was considered to be the last stop before jail for most of those children. They had a history of a lot of destruction of property, you know, assaults on people. I had a child who set somebody's house on fire. You know, they just did a lot of bad things. And they had a very, of course, bad reputation, even among the therapists that I was working with. But my supervisor started me there one day a week, and I was comfortable, so I ended up working there pretty much full time for 12 years. And what I learned about those children is that it wasn't, and most of the kids that were there were Black. But what I learned was that, you know, it wasn't that they were bad people. In fact, if they had an opportunity to be helpful when we were moving from one school site to another, they were jumped at the chance to be able to help us get things together and move things. I think they were probably feeling hopeful about moving to a much better building than the one that we were living in, dealing with. And I taught them to meditate, and it was so amazing when these children were able to meditate and feel peaceful for the first time. It blew me away to see their response to how that could feel. And you know, we look at the history of how Black people have been treated in our society for, of course, hundreds of years. The abuse, the disrespect on multiple levels by their teachers, you know, previous teachers, grade school and everything, strangers in society that would walk the other way or give somebody a look, you know, like, I don't want to be around you, whatever that would be. Multiple levels of being disrespected by society, and messages in the movies, and just there's so much. It kind of surprises me that there isn't even more mental illness when I think about all the things that have happened. You know, anybody who's been through trauma in their life, they can have compassion, hopefully have compassion for themselves and for others because of that trauma. But we haven't historically had much compassion or even awareness of what it's like to be a Black person growing up in our society. And what I had read something before I took that job. I read about a teacher who had been very successful with a group of Black children in a school. Maybe it was in Chicago. And there was a research project that studied those kids at the time that they were in school with her and then followed them for the next 30 years of their lives. And those children grew up to be doctors and lawyers and teachers and very productive people in society. So they, you know, somebody was following up on the research study and went back and talked to the teacher. They found her, she was now an old woman, and asked her, what did you do differently? Because, you know, so many of your the kids that you worked with, they grew up and became successful people in the world. And she said, it's very simple. I loved those boys. That had a profound impact on me. And that's what I did when I worked with those children at that school. And those kids, they graduated. They either returned to their neighborhood school or they graduated from that school. They did things that nobody predicted they would be able to do. This school was considered the end of the line before jail.
Mary, thank you for sharing your perspective. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So we're talking right now about Mental Health Awareness Month. And if you or a loved one is in need of any kind of mental health counseling, please call 211. That's 211. The WMNF mission calendar for the month of May is Mental Health Awareness. And we just heard a little bit of an online conversation that was hosted by the ACLU of Florida called Mental Health in the Black Community. It features Darnell Lamont Walker, the award-winning writer, filmmaker, and artist. And if you'd like to comment on this, you can either email us, dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Please sign your name, or you can give us a call at 813-239-9663. It's 12:33 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan, and we're going to transition in just a minute or two to a short radio program called Reimagining a Better World. And this episode will be all about reimagining public safety. It's about alternatives to policing, organizing around safety in your community, and about budgeting for safety in your community. But first, we're going to take a very short music break. We'll hear some Bob Marley, and then we'll be right back with Reimagining a Better World. This is WMNF Tampa. I'm Sean Canaan. Please stay with us. So we will take more phone calls later. The number is 813-239-9663 here on WMNF Tampa. You might also be listening on WMNF.org or on the WMNF smartphone app. And if you call 813-239-9663, you'll talk to our wonderful phone volunteer, Clark, and she'll put you on the air for us. You can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433. Well, here, I'm going to play a little bit from this new to me radio program. It's called Reimagining a Better World. And so this episode that we're going to hear part of is all about reimagining public safety, reimagining police. It's about alternatives to policing, organizing, and budgeting. And I play it in the context of tomorrow's one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd. He was killed by police in Minnesota. One of those police has already been found guilty of murder and manslaughter. And so I'm playing this in the context of that one-year anniversary. So give us a call, 813-239-9663, if you'd like to say anything about this program. Again, this is Reimagining a Better World. It's an episode about reimagining public safety here on WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM.
This is Reimagining a Better World, a collaboration of Yes Media and Public News Service. I'm Manoa Changa.
And I'm Laura Rossbrow Tellum.
Today, we will be talking about reimagining public safety. A lot of the focus last year was on protests that arose after the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis and Breonna Taylor by police in Louisville. There hasn't been as much emphasis on how communities themselves have been looking at creating alternatives and talking through what it means to keep them safe.
What do you think of when you hear public safety and police? Like, Noah, when was the first time you ever thought about public safety?
I mean, I've always grown up in Black and inner city communities, so I've always seen and noticed the police. Police are always present. Thinking about my safety, we moved to Chicago around fifth, sixth grade, and that is when I can really remember thinking about being safe. I want to say maybe it was high school. We got metal detectors my senior year, later in the year, after Columbine happening. And this is not to make light of, you know, school shootings, which are very serious issues in gun violence. But at the time, it just didn't seem like it actually had anything to do with our actual reality and actual concerns for our safety and just a response to something that happened to people in other places. There's a really rich conversation that actually does take into consideration violence that happens in different types of communities and what are some of the alternatives that needs to be a part of conversations around gun violence prevention that did not exist 20 plus years ago.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating what you're saying about Columbine. Mostly white high school, white kids who shoot up the school, right? And at that moment in time, I was in middle school. And I went to a private middle school, mostly white, no metal detectors, right? Also didn't have any security that I remember at my high school. So this thing happens, totally different ramifications, just because I lived in this higher income, mostly white community.
And so specifically for this conversation, there were these two issues that really resonated with me over the summertime when I was covering the protests. And I wanted to talk about block by block organizing and participatory budgeting, because these were two conversations, these were two opportunity points that I didn't see as many connections being made to the protesting and the work that people were doing. Because folks would focus on the protests, but you would also have people showing up virtually at city council meetings and making demands of local electeds. You also had people who were doing a form of mutual aid in a sense of helping each other out in their communities to keep each other safe.
So the first thing that we're going to look at is what's called block by block organizing or community defense. And this specifically was going on in Minneapolis during the protest this summer. And some residents wanted to create networks in their neighborhoods as alternatives to police, like without the government, without anything. And there are obviously pros and cons to this, and we're going to hear more about it.
And later in the episode, we're going to talk about participatory budgeting, or PB, as some folks call it, which began in Brazil in 1989. Participatory budgeting is a way for communities to have a direct say in spending priorities. So it's not just the vote yes or no on whether spending should happen or whether something should occur. It is really digging in and being a part of the process of setting the agenda. And there are thousands of cities and government institutions and agencies, including schools, across the world that have utilized this practice.
Now, let's get to block by block organizing in Minneapolis. We talked with two people who were right up in it. The first person we spoke with was Magdalena Caluza, who's a climate organizer with the nonprofit Take Action Minnesota.
I live, let's see, about two blocks from the George Floyd Memorial Square, where George Floyd was murdered at the hands of the police, and in a neighborhood called Powderhorn Park.
Magdalena, who uses they and them pronouns, says collaborating with neighbors in the summer led to people being more connected on a regular basis.
We've had many, many neighborhood gatherings. Many are just celebratory and relational, places to get to know each other. And last night we had a solstice one in the alley. And so the alley for two blocks has been decked out with tinsel and Christmas lights. People were grilling, sharing teas, sharing bonfires, candles. And what that looks like is that we know so many more of our neighbors than we did before the uprising.
The uprising, of course, was the nationwide protest following the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Local Black, Indigenous, and people of color-led groups were already organizing against police violence and responded to this crisis. Jamie Schwayz-Nettle, co-owner of Moon Palace Books and Cafe in South Minneapolis, describes seeing the immediate aftermath unfold in real time.
I just ended up spending 3 days and nights virtually without sleeping in front of our building, on the roof of the building, just watching police shoot tear gas grenades at customers who were lined up to pick up pizzas from us that they'd ordered online, or drive their cruisers at high speeds with no headlights on during the night across our lawn, and seeing, you know, ultimately all the buildings being burnt down. And it was just like a pretty traumatic few nights and days.
People set a number of businesses on fire and burned down a police station. Jamie says it was a confusing time.
There was this feeling of like the police are out here and doing harm to our community. And then at the same time, our community is being harmed and the businesses and buildings that our community operates out of are being burnt down. And it's unclear who's doing that.
Jamie texted a friend to figure out what to do.
And I was like, do you know if somebody's going to be doing something to help people? Since the police have essentially evacuated the city except to shoot tear gas at us and grenades, is there anybody that's organizing some sort of way that we can actually coordinate our efforts to defend our blocks and each other? So this friend of mine was like, yeah, well, our city council person, Alondra Cano, who we both know, he's like, yeah, Alondra and I are going to have a meeting in the park. You should help us facilitate it.
So Jamie, along with many others, helped facilitate one of the first meetings. This gathering was at Powderhorn Park, a central point for community groups over the summer. Jamie says it was the first time some people talked to their neighbors.
I got to the park and 1,000 people showed up. And before the meeting started, I saw a dear old friend of mine who I've known for 20 years, who we both used to live near each other in New Orleans and kind of have already been through watching a city that we were connected to be destroyed. And it was 5 minutes before I was supposed to help facilitate this meeting in the park with 1,000 people. My friend and I were both just fell on the ground sobbing for 5 minutes. And then I got up and was like, okay, hello.
This is the program Reimagining a Better World. This episode is all about reimagining public safety. It's about alternatives to policing, organizing, and budgeting. My name is Sean Canan, and this is WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM. It's 12:43 in the afternoon. You're listening to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM on WMNF.org and on the WMNF app. And we're remembering the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minnesota police. And this show is about reimagining public safety, about alternatives to policing, organizing, and budgeting. And to that note, I just want to remind people that earlier in the day, civil rights groups in Tampa have applauded Tampa City Council's vote on a revamped citizen review board, and they are slamming Tampa Mayor Jane Castor's bid for control, in their words. So that was something that happened earlier today, and we're going to keep an eye on that story as it continues to develop. We've been watching it for years, of course, but it's a lot of what they're talking about in this radio program, Reimagining a Better World, about alternatives to policing, about organizing around safety and around budgeting for police and safety. Those are things that this group is, the Tampa Bay civil rights group is organizing around. It's easy for me to say. 813-239-9663. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. We're going to continue with this radio program in just a second. Our emailer, James Burke, has written back to clarify that the snowflake that he was referring to is Darnell, the filmmaker that we heard from earlier. He didn't elaborate why he was giving him that moniker, Snowflake, but Darnell Lamont Walker earlier was talking about mental health in the Black community. He was talking about how people can share their stories and can get support from one another. And so our emailer, James, is saying that he's calling him a snowflake. 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org. Let's listen to one more segment here of this Reimagining a Better World radio show, this episode about reimagining public safety here on WMNF Tampa.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reimagining a Better World. I'm Laura Rossbrow-Tellum. In this episode, we're reimagining public safety. First, we're looking at a strategy that was big in Minneapolis last summer called block-by-block organizing, where community members protected their own neighborhoods as an alternative to the police. Magdalena, who you heard from earlier, was also at that initial gathering at Powderhorn Park.
There happens to be a hillside across from the stage, almost like amphitheater seating. So it was really a phenomenal space for people to gather and talk about what was happening and how we were going to solve it.
We just tried to figure out a way to have some kind of decentralized way that everyone could connect with their closest neighbors and also all with each other. We came up with the idea of like create sort of like a physical representation of the neighborhood in the park where we're like,
people who live north of the park went to the north end of the park, or south of the park, you know, so using the park as almost a map, and then talk with their own neighbors and figure out what they wanted their solutions to be at a more specific geographic level.
Just trying to get a thing where people could then find a group of 10 people who lived the closest to them of anyone at the meeting. And then we were just like, talk amongst yourselves, exchange information, exchange emails, and pick a contact person and come up and come to the stage.
What we saw was a lot of WhatsApp loops, signal threads, and email chains set up so that people could have each other's contact info, be able to ask each other for help and offer each other support. And we saw more communication and coordination between race and class than we normally do. There was massive mutual aid. So people were gathering baby supplies, sanitary supplies, personal protective equipment, food, tons of food. And there were so many pop-up pantries for people to access because a lot of the grocery stores in the area were closed and people couldn't, if you didn't have a car to get to the suburbs, outer ring suburbs, you couldn't get food.
It was a pretty amazing decentralized way to organize people, and it was a great thing that could happen quickly.
This decentralized aspect was a key element to organizing. Each block made its own rules.
There were things about it that were really challenging. Like, there's some people who just like had to go check on an older relative or deliver food to someone because this was during COVID.
Jamie says his neighborhood is very typical for South Minneapolis. Mostly single-family homes with yards, many about 100 years old. A classic Midwestern grid layout, rectangular, with an alley between each block, detached garages. On his block, they had a few people sitting and watching throughout the night. When Jamie took a turn, he headed out with his big maglite flashlight late in the night and checked on the guards of his block.
One block to the north of us, however they organized it, there were just like three dad dudes standing out in the middle of the street all night with their guns strapped outside their shirts. And that was really different than what we were doing on our block. And one block to the south of us, people had just pushed giant puppets into the intersections at night. So, you know, it was like every block was really different.
He shared some examples of competing concerns.
So there were people trying to travel through the neighborhood for very legitimate, important reasons who would then come to a block where the people on the block would be shouting at them, you know, who are you? What right do you have to be here? Things like that. And it was really beautiful and amazing. And also there were definitely some problems with it.
We're all on a WhatsApp loop together. And during the summer, those people were meeting in a church parking lot. They set up some small working groups. One was asset mapping for the neighborhood. Another one was de-escalation training and resource sharing for the neighborhood.
They ended up focusing on something pretty intense.
I joined this very ad hoc fire squad, essentially, which I called on some friends who are firefighters and said, what are like a few basics you would say we need to know? Obviously, we can't learn the extremely incredible trade of firefighting in a night or two, but what are some things you think we need to know? Because we were seeing accelerants planted around the neighborhood. We were seeing fires popping up. And so we wanted to have a network of neighbors who were prepared to address small emergencies, at least, and predominantly for the protection of people. I was on signal threads with people coordinating supplies. And then we also had a dispatch so that we could, you know, well, there's something happening here. There's something happening there. And we could coordinate who's closest, who's able to go there. And do we need multiple cars full of people to go? How big is the emergency?
Magdalena was inspired by their neighbor's resilience.
At 11 p.m., I would show up at Chicago and 38th because we had been told there was an accelerant at the gas station. And there's a whole bunch of other friends and neighbors that I know from different parts of the community are also there to address the emergency. So how incredible is that to, you know, in the middle of the night in this really scary time, you come somewhere and you see that so many other people are also being courageous and stepping up for their community.
What you're saying in terms of you, for example, helping out, put out fires, and you were talking earlier about de-escalation strategies. It's almost like you all assembled your own local government on your own. What did that feel like?
I'm glowing as I talk to you. I feel chills in my body, remembering seeing people out on the streets, meeting so many community needs. And it was thrilling, and it was encouraging, and it was very affirming. We know what we need, and we know what our communities need. And having relationships that can weather storms, having relationships that can get through thick and thin, means that we can meet those needs.
That's obviously very positive, but I could also imagine you being potentially pissed off, like the government abandoned you.
I'll be honest, I think our government fails to meet community needs. I'm a firm believer that government can do more to meet human needs. I'd love to see community continue to find our own solutions.
As Magdalena mentioned toward the beginning, her neighborhood network is still pretty active. Jamie, the bookstore owner, his is less so. He says a bunch of people are just burnt out. But things are shifting in the city.
Madam President, on behalf of the Budget Committee, I move adoption of a resolution approving the 2020 property tax levies to be paid in 2021.
In early December, the Minneapolis City Council unanimously approved a budget that diverts $8 million away from the police department towards violence prevention, mental health, and other services. That's about a 4% reduction from the police. Beyond Minneapolis, a number of cities around the country are reallocating some money from police departments, including Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, New York, and Austin. After the break, you'll hear about a policy-related public safety strategy. It's called participatory budgeting, where residents really shape how to spend public money.
You're listening to a segment of Reimagining a Better World. This episode is all about reimagining public safety. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. My name is Sean Canan, and this is Midpoint Monday at 12:52 in the afternoon, and we're taking your calls. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org, or you can text 813-433-0885. Joining us on the line now is Connie Burton from Tampa. Connie, you want to talk about this press conference that I've been mentioning?
Yes, I do, and thanks for the show. I just want to say it's kind of very hard to reimagine a better community, a better world, when so much of destabilization occurs. And so the press conference focused on the fact that in this city, the controlling power, which would be the mayor, simply cannot reimagine communities having voices. And so what we are seeing happening now is that the challenge against the formation of the Citizens Review Board that would allow city council members to appoint one person and give the mayor the ability to appoint three. And so the mayor, in my opinion, cannot relinquish her power over the police department and the controller of the continual formation of a police state. And as long as we have those patterns of practice, we're not able to build any foundation of trust, because it's not just police in itself, but it's a control on a city, and especially a marginalized community that is not able to foster a vision on how we can have a better city, better communities, when the voices of the people are so muted. So again, thank you for the show.
And thank you, Connie. And let me ask you this. So the Citizen Review Board that's been passed by the Tampa City Council, that's different from what Mayor Jane Castor is proposing. Why do you prefer, it sounds like you prefer the one that was passed by City Council? You mentioned representation and who picks, who's on the council, on the Citizen Review Board, but what about enforcement power and so forth?
Well, I think it was too much for this body to even imagine making a petition to the city where you have a strong form of mayor governance that would have asked for the body to have any real power. So we were saying, more or less, we will start off with being a strong listening session where the council would appoint their people, an unbiased body that had still, in my opinion, no real control, but at least they would have the ability to hear actual people account of what happened. And then the balance from that is that it would be swayed by having the authority of the police making the final decision. It is no incident. I mean, the mayor has had a 30-year tenure as being the police chief, followed by the mayor, people that has been loyal to her camp, that I don't feel that having it swayed with the mayor having control and power, we would have gotten a better outcome. So the ordinance did not speak to having any subpoena power, any authority on that matter, but the fact of the matter that it is being so shut down by the mayor should give citizens the impression that this city has, under its leadership, has the inability to move forward, even after the horrendous killings that have happened throughout this nation, as well as unsolved issues in our community. We still haven't had a resolution on the Arthur Green death. Also, there is real trauma in our community as it relates to the Black community and police relations.
Well, Connie, thanks so much for your comments.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for calling in. And we're going to listen to, on WMNF Tampa, just a little bit more of this Reimagining a Better World episode about alternatives to policing, organizing, and I think the segment that's coming up is more about budgeting, about how communities can take hold of their budgeting process locally and do things like redirect some of the funds that go that have been traditionally gone to police. So here's a little bit more of Reimagining a Better World on WMNF Tampa.
Welcome back. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reimagining a Better World. I'm Anoa Changa.
And I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. In this episode, we've been reimagining public safety. Earlier in the show, we heard from two Minneapolis residents about block-by-block organizing, an alternative for policing and community safety.
As we continue our journey of reimagining public safety, we wanted to explore other community-centered strategies. One process we came across was participatory budgeting. With calls for reimagining municipal budgets, including defunding the police, we reached out to Sherry Davis and Cristania De Leon from the Participatory Budgeting Project to help shine some light on how this process works.
All right, I'm going to hit record on my voice recorder. I'm ready to rock when you are.
Yeah, same here.
Sherry starts us off with an explanation of the basic function of participatory budgeting.
Participatory budgeting is a process that allows community members to directly decide how a portion of government funds, public funds, tax dollars are spent.
Sherry and Cristania work with governments and other groups to involve community members so they have more power to choose funding priorities.
What's the role and voice of community in facilitating that? Not just in testifying and saying, yes, I agree with this bill, please pass it, but in shaping the actual intervention, the purpose of the legislation, and being really centered in how we message, how we advocate, what that looks like.
Cristania saw participatory budgeting, or as she calls it, PB, as another means of encouraging community leadership.
At the core of PB as a practice is community leadership that is supported by others, but is really dictated by frontline communities. And so I learned about it. I wanted to bring it to my organization. I wanted to bring it to my community.
And Sherry walks us through the difference between a traditional budgeting process with varying levels of community input and participatory budgeting.
Participatory budgeting creates an opportunity for community members really to identify, vision, radically imagine, and reckon with what they need, what has happened, and what has not happened yet that should. A lot of Chris's work right now has been talking to communities across the country to really understand how participatory budgeting can be used as a mechanism that allows community and government to break down barriers, really understand what needs are, and move away from continuing to invest in things that have proven to cause harm, and instead invest in things that promote health and safety in a way that centers equity, really what community identifies as equity.
Well, that's a show called Reimagining a Better World, and that episode was about reimagining public safety. It's about alternatives to policing, organizing, and budgeting. This is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. Thanks to everyone who called in or emailed or texted, and I want to thank Clark for answering our phones. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. Stay tuned now for Franco Silva's Latino 54, some great Latin music. That's coming up after NPR headlines. Over on our HD3 stream, The Source, you can hear Tom Hartman's show live, the second hour. And WMNF came up a little bit short in our membership drive last week, so you can help us with your donation right now at WMNF.org. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening.